That is the meaning of the path of prayer. And it leads ultimately to a climax when the idol that one is so assiduously crafting can no longer support the intensity of divine presence that is coming through, and it shatters. The idol is shattered. And at the same moment, the creator of the idol is shattered. God is no more. You are no more. There's only communion in oneness. Ineffable, beyond all form. So we come now to the third pillar. And that is Soam. Soam is a word that is often translated as fasting. And this is the month of Soam. This is the month of fasting, Ramadan. But Soam has a more original etymology. And that is, it means repose, rest. This is something that the ancients understood very well, that life, the proper rhythm of life, depended upon balance between activity and repose. That is a lesson that our society needs profoundly to learn. We are so immersed in stimulus, in preoccupations, in plans and agendas and deadlines, that we have forgotten the art of repose. And even if we assign a certain time for ourselves, time off from work or off from one's responsibilities, we've become so habituated to busyness that even when we are ostensibly vacationing, resting, true repose is something distant, something unobtainable. Repose is an art, and prayer is a part of that art, to be able at certain times of the day, according to a rhythmic pattern, to step out of the intoxication of one's involvement, to step back, to breathe, to breathe, to be with reality. That is part of the art of repose. Now, this practice of Soam in the month of Ramadan is a very wonderful practice. It actually predates the Islamic revelation, and it was practiced by the Hanifs, the primordial mystic monotheists of the desert. They practiced what they called Tahannuth, which was a retreat done each year during this sacred month, the month of Ramadan. And this tradition was extended and deepened in the Islamic tradition. The most exoteric dimension of this is to refrain from eating and drinking, and also sexual intercourse, from the hours of from sunrise to sunset. And at this level of repose, there is a repose of the body, when the body refrains from digestion, from metabolism, and burns away excessive elements, and the body becomes in this way refined through a practice of catharsis, of purification, heightened sensitivity. And one understands what it is to be hungry and to put oneself through hunger voluntarily is a kind of voluntary death, as Sheikh Llewellyn was saying, mutu qabbal an tamutu. To experience the dignity of independence, independence from sustenance, the dignity of dwelling in the state of the empty belly. One finds in that state that one realizes that not only are so-called addictive substances habit-forming and intoxicating, but all food and drink is intoxicating. And one experiences a kind of sobriety when one at certain times does without. But that is just the most exoteric dimension of fasting, albeit a very useful and profoundly beneficial practice. But there are other deeper levels of Saum. In the Quran Sharif, it is said that the angel Gabriel conveyed a message to Mary, the mother of Jesus, peace be upon them, and said, "Go and sit under a tree, and if anyone approaches you, say, 'I cannot speak, for I have pledged a fast, I have pledged a saum to Ar-Rahman, I have pledged a fast to the All-Merciful.'" It's a wonderful ayah, sign of the Quran, and there's in each verse of every scripture, there's seven levels of meaning. It's very difficult to even begin to understand these levels of meaning when one is working with an English translation. But in this verse it is said, "I have made dedicated a fast to Ar-Rahman." Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim, these are names of God referring to the compassion, the mercy, the grace of God. But these are words that come from the root Rahma, which is related to the womb. The universe is understood by the mystic as a womb, as a place of nurturance, that it is the essence of the divine relation to humanity and to all created beings, that that relation is compassionate, protective, loving. That is a realization of the mystics when the heart is opened, that this whole cosmos is a womb. And so it was said that Mary, when she was expecting the birth of prophet Jesus, that she was dedicating a fast to the womb-like quality of the universe. And her fast was not a fast of abstaining from food and drink. Her fast was a fast of abstaining from conversation. She was told to be silent. That is another kind of fast. And we realize that so much of our identity is contingent upon social signals, our immersion in the linguistic field. We see how much we define ourselves and understand ourselves according to our impression of the impression that other people have of us. So it's twice removed from the truth of our own being. And we find that our thought is entirely conditioned by our mode of language. And so if you go to another country, if you speak a second language and go to another country, you'll find that you begin to also think in that other language and dream in that other language. And one of the interesting consequences of that is that different kinds of ideas are possible, different shades of meaning that aren't fully articulated in this language are articulated in a different language. There might be shades of meaning that are possible in this language that aren't possible in the other language. But you see that insofar as you are working within one language, there's only one set of possibilities. Another language is another set of perceptions, and so on. But then there's something else that's possible, which is it's possible to stand outside of all of those systems of thought and experience a mode of thought which isn't dependent on the categories of language. And one doesn't learn that by speaking another language. One learns that by renouncing language altogether, going into silence. Silence is a true form of som, of rest and repose. And in all spiritual traditions, the benefits of this practice have been emphasized. To take a certain period of each day for silence, to savor that silence, to know, turn off your phone, know that you are not answerable to the interrogation of other people. You have no need to justify yourself, to claim anything or describe anything. Simply exist in that silence. And if you've done that, if you've done that for a certain period of time, you find how profoundly it changes your perception of yourself, perception of the world. And you'll find that when you are drawn back into the world, at first it's difficult. It's difficult to speak. One is tentative. One is hesitant. But then one finds that one can maintain an inner silence, speak when necessary, and yet always be aware of how all words arise from and return to this absolute silence. Because what are words? How is it that the ideas that I'm expressing are reverberating in your mind? It is that I am forming those words with my mouth. Of what am I forming them? Of the breath. So the essence of speech is breath. Pure breath rising up, undelimited. That is the pure sound. That sound then becomes conditioned according to the need to express something particular. In the same way, the Sufis say that the universe originated as a pure breath, unconditioned, the nafas ar-Rahman, the divine breath of compassion. And that in the accommodation of the cosmos, that breath became conditioned and vibrated according to a variety of tones and rhythms, producing all of the sound that exists and all of the meaning that exists. But all of that meaning came from some singular essence that is the simple quality of breath, and it all returns to that quality of breath. And so when one remembers this, then one is highly conscious of the privilege of speech. And each word then becomes a creative act, because one realizes that as God created reality through the sounding of the breath, so our breath is the most precious thing we are given and the greatest trust we are given is the responsibility to sound that breath in such a way that we are the delegate of the divine will. The divine will operates in the macrocosm through the universal breath, and our personal breath has been given to us in order to enunciate the meaning that represents the signature of our soul in life. But most often what we are inscribing is graffiti. We have the opportunity, this one life, to etch something in the tablet of nature that will be a message that will outlast our personal life when this body is moldering in the ground and is recycled and giving birth to innumerable creatures. That particular manifestation that is this existence, it will re-echo in the vibrations of the words that we have spoken. And when those words have been grounded in the universal breath, in the silence, then those words will reverberate down the ages. And all of us who are gathered here together, we are brought together now by the grace of the words of the past, the words of the great prophets and saints and masters who have called us together by the continuous reverberation of their sacred speech. So this is a further level of som, of repose, the repose of silence. And then there's a still more subtle level. First there's fasting of the body. Then you can say silence is fasting of the mind. Then there's a fasting of the heart. When the body fasts, you feel hunger. Your stomach is grumbling. You see something nice to eat, but you know you're fasting and you can't partake of it. So you feel that there's a need, but you don't satisfy the need. So there's an interval established between a need and the satisfaction of the need. And ordinarily, when we're not fasting, there is no interval between the need and the satisfaction of the need. We feel the imperative of it so urgently that every little need, every little impulse needs, demands its immediate satisfaction. Well, Sufism is a path of desire, a path that respects desire, respects our desire as rooted in the divine desire. But in order to truly know our desire, we have to get beyond the place where we're dissipating our desire constantly in these little minuscule victories, satiating our impulses immediately. Let us see what it is like to dwell in the desire, to feel the need and not yet act on the need, to reside within the need, to go deeply within the need. That is what we do with our bodies when we refrain from eating. Now that is what the heart can do. Instead of grasping addictively at objects that compensate for what it feels is missing, for a moment reside in the feeling of loss, reside in the feeling of the separation, of the absence, and accept it. Go into its depths. And one just might find that that which satisfies the need is not satisfied by reaching out for it, but by reaching back into the need, in the very essence of the need. That which the need seeks is already there. One feels it at just the moment when one knows with one's body, heart, and soul absolutely that one cannot do without it. One sees it so clearly, and suddenly there it is. As it is said in the hadith, whosoever knows himself in poverty and indigence, knows his Lord, his Rabb. In fullness and completion. And as Shamsi Tabriz said, there is one thing that you can offer to God, one thing that God does not have. That is your need. Feel it, know it, and offer it up. That is the true meaning of psalm, fasting. Then we come to the fourth pillar, and that is zakat, which means charity. And the tradition is at the end of the month of Ramadan, after one has felt one's need, one is in a position to identify with others who are in need. If one has not emptied one's belly, it's hard to know the straits of one who lives in hunger, not voluntarily, but involuntarily. But when one has experienced it in this way, a field of sympathetic resonance opens up. One is no longer exclusively concerned with one's own interests. And then that is the time for zakat, and that means charity. It means giving a portion of what you have. The tradition is that of 200 dinars, five are given. So 2.5% of your annual assets are distributed to those in need. And this beautiful act is one that has multiple benefits. One is that one has to make an accounting of what one possesses. That is a practice that is called by the Sufis muhasaba. It's a form of contemplation. When you look at every part of your life, you look at everything that you possess in minute detail, and you experience the gratitude that comes with not taking everything for granted, but looking at everything and feeling it's the gift that it represents. We are ordinarily so preoccupied with collecting things that we don't realize that all that we enjoy in life is a gift. It's all a gift. For example, if you were just to think of a room in your house, just one room, and think about, just for a moment now, look into that room and examine the different objects there. Then look at one single object and ask yourself, what are the components of this object? What are the materials with which it was made? Where have those materials come from? What kind of workmanship has gone into that object? How has it been transported? Who are the people who have produced it? Who are the people who have brought it into my care? And you realize that the slightest thing that we take for granted is the result of eons of cosmic evolution, in which the substance of this planet was molded in the furnaces of the stars, in which millennia by millennia, the inorganic substance of matter evolved into organicity, and this whole complex ecology of being has been birthed, and that we are the recipients of so much enrichment, so much beauty of divine manufacture, and also so much history on the part of humanity in the arts, in the sciences. Imagine your television. Could you single-handedly collect the ingredients in your television? Could you assemble them? Would one know how to do it? How many years of study would it take to be able to assemble a television? We are the beneficiaries of so much that is completely beyond what we are personally capable of, and yet we take it for granted. And so we want to review everything that we possess. And then we have to ask ourselves, we feel the gratitude for the benefit that accrues to us, but then we start to ask ourselves, what does it mean, after all, to possess anything? Isn't it a strange idea to say that I own something or I possess something? What is the relationship between me and the thing? At most, you can say there's proximity. You're nearby that thing. But is there any other magical existing relationship between the two? That thing has come into your proximity, and eventually, sooner or later, it will go. Another part of muhasaba is foreseeing the process by which things will go. Of course, one can never know exactly, but one does know that in death, everything will be dispensed with. And you can envision what that will look like. The garage sales, the things that you have carefully, assiduously collected year by year over time, you've brought them all together, how that will go. Some things will be thrown in the rubbish heap, other things will be possessed by someone else. So we have these objects in our life. And for so many of us, or for so much of our life, the collecting of these things and maintaining of these things seems to be the goal. But then at a certain point, we realize that our goal is not the things. We thought that the things would give us happiness, but happiness comes from our own inner state. It doesn't come from outside. So then at that point, one renounces the things, tarki dunya. Say, I'm not going to strive after objects, but what instead I'll strive after are states, beautiful states, happiness, peace, bliss, serenity. So one practices meditation, yoga, reads poetry, and one discovers a beautiful world that is much more poetic, elegant than that crass and superficial world of material objects. And one becomes an aficionado of beautiful states, of qualities of light. One begins to have experiences of light ranging from the most violent bolt of thunder to the most refined, fragile, luminous splendor, shimmering. One becomes a pursuer of beautiful inner states. And what then one may make an accounting of these states and say that these are my possessions. But then again, one may begin to question and say, am I not repeating the same pattern of avarice, of greed, trying to latch on to something? Now it's internal. Now it's at a finer level. But the essential error remains that I'm taking for granted all that I receive. I receive the gift, but who is the giver? What is important is not the gift, but the intention behind the gift, the sincerity of feeling of the one who has given it. And then one renounces not only the outer objects, but the inner objects in favor of the ideal of God. That is when one cultivates a relationship directly with God and one cries out like Rabia al-Adawiyya, O God, if I worshipped you for desire for heaven, then bolt its gates before me. And if I worshipped you for fear of hell, then burn me in its fires. But if my worship was motivated by nothing other than the desire for your presence, do not deny me your intimacy. So that is a kind of zakat. That is a kind of charity. At each stage, there is a giving up, a renunciation. First, appreciating what you have been given materially, but sharing it with those who need, and not attaching oneself to it. And then identifying with the inner beauty of the gifts that one has received, but then giving those freely and turning toward the giver. This is all work done on the path of charity. And charity might seem like a kind act, an act of kindness toward others, but ultimately the greatest kindness that the giver does is the kindness that is done to oneself. It's liberating. Now finally we come to the fifth pillar, and that is Hajj. Hajj means pilgrimage. And in the Islamic tradition, the pilgrimage is to the Kaaba. The Kaaba is the center toward which the worshippers pray from all corners of the world. And finally, God willing, once in a lifetime, make their way there in person to congregate, arriving from all different points and converging at that one central point that was a sacred place consecrated by Hazrat Abraham, peace be upon him, and reconsecrated by the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And every religion has its heart center, its place which is the axis of worship. And to physically go there is a process of movement in space, but also an inner movement of leaving behind the familiar routines to unite with people who are drawn together from all over the world, drawn by that same desire to unite beyond language and culture as brothers and sisters in the presence of the one ideal whom we all share. To go to a place where the prophetic power reverberates, because the prophet has spoken there, has instilled a word of power there that is accessible. In every divine dispensation, this path is open. But there is also an esoteric dimension of Hajj, and that is the pilgrimage to the center of one's own being, the heart. قَلْبَ الْإِنسَانِ بَيْتَ رَحْمَانِ. The heart of the human being is the house of God, the shrine of the divine. And so the true Hajj, the true spiritual pilgrimage, is the pilgrimage to the heart, to return again and again to the heart. The heart is the locus of integration, the place of unity, where heaven and earth converge. As Mir Taqi Mir said, the heart, which seems nothing other than a clot of blood, is a whirlwind mingling heaven and earth by its force, a vortex. The heart resides at the plane of Malakut, mediating between the higher levels of transcendence and the lower levels of immanence. It is there that the whole gist of our life experience is distilled. And it is there that the divine intelligence is concretized. So there's two-way traffic. There's the process of the sublimation of the experience of life on earth and the process of the descent of meaningfulness from eternity. And these two channels converge in this place of integration that is the heart. And we begin to work with the heart, and we will end our time together now working with the physical heart, because there's a direct relationship between the physical heart and the spiritual heart. It is through the awareness of the physical heart that we open to the awareness of the spiritual heart. It is told there was once a fairy, and she was wandering along, and she came across a dollhouse. Now, a fairy is a creature of great beauty. Allahul Jamil wa yuhibbul Jamal. God is beautiful and loves beauty. God, like this fairy, is beyond even what is implied in the allegory of the fairy. God is endlessly beautiful. And yet that beauty needs a witness. And so the fairy, not realizing her own beauty, came upon a dollhouse. She was looking inside the dollhouse through the windows, and she thought, how charming. I would love to see what life is like inside that dollhouse. But she was too big to fit in through the front door. But she was a magical being, so she could divide herself into different parts. So she separated all the parts of her body, and one hand went in through the front door, ear went through the window, etc. And then all the parts met up with each other inside. But now something had changed. The parts no longer recognize each other. And they started rubbing up against each other and opposing each other and fighting. And the foot said to the ankle, stay away from me, I have nothing to do with you. And so on. And so it was all chaos in the dollhouse. Continuous bickering, until suddenly a voice was heard. That voice was the voice of one organ, the organ whose job was to connect up all of the parts. That was the heart. And the heart said, listen, brothers and sisters, remember. Become members once again of that one body. And the heart's call was so deeply heard by all of the different parts of the body that they all came together, forming the body of the fairy. And then the fairy could know what it was to experience life fully, truly, in that accommodation. That is the story of our personal heart. It's also the story of the heart of the world. That is the story of the call that we are hearing in our time, the call to transcend the boundaries of nationality and religion and to unite in the awareness of the unity, not only of the human species, but of the whole of being. That is the call of the heart. So we close now, just briefly, turning within. As you inhale, draw the breath into the heart. And as you exhale, relax the armoring, the hardened resistance that constitutes a layer of protection by which we defend the sensitive inner tissue from the hard knocks of the world. And yet in doing so, in sheltering ourselves from pain, we numb the most living organ of the body, the most sensitive, the most intelligent, the most inclusive part of our being, the heart. And so the heart slumbers, spared pain, but also denied joy. Yet if we would willingly accept the pain, we would find that pain is not so bad, and that it contains in its depths a secret joy. Worse than pain is the suffering that is the consequence of avoiding the pain. So to breathe into the heart is to stimulate, sensitize tissues that have been dormant, clenched in the fist of the breast, now relaxing the breast, letting the tissues soften and expand, and with each inhalation letting the breath enter still more deeply into the inner cockles of the heart, probing its inner fibers, feeling the raw exposure, sensitivity, ticklishness, even soreness of the open heart, but keeping it open. And feeling its rhythm. And know that this rhythm is the true guide on one's life path, and that its guidance is the only authority whom one can trust. It is simple, it is here, it knows, it has only to be asked. And feel the echo of the heart in the hands, in the feet, in the head. And sense how its ripples, its pulsation, continue to emanate out into the environment without boundary. The heart is unbounded. And the heart's rippling waves intersect with the waves of other hearts. All immersed, all saturated in the compassionate, loving presence of the womb-like divinity. When you're ready, open your eyes and simply resolve that, come what may, I shall be aware of this pulsation, this rhythm, and let it always guide me. Amen. And we close now with the prayer Khatum. O Thou, who art the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the Lord of heaven and earth, open our hearts that we may hear Thy voice, which constantly cometh from within. Disclose to us Thy divine light, which is hidden in our souls, that we may know and understand life better. Most merciful and compassionate God, give us Thy great goodness. Teach us Thy loving forgiveness. Raise us above the distinctions and differences which divide us. Send us the peace of Thy divine Spirit, and unite us all in Thy perfect being.